The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello there, this is Fred Brack reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State magazine. Today's reading of Our State is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting our podcast for over 10 years. Thank you, Carter Glass. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. And now it's time to return one more time to the September 2021 edition of Our State magazine, celebrating North Carolina. The theme we've been reading about this month is Preserved, Putting Up the Harvest, and all sorts of things like that. But this is the last reading of the month, so you know what that means if you're a regular listener. We're going to be reading from 1970s, the Decade of Disruption. The current issue has an article entitled Fatal Distraction. And there's a picture of an Eastern Airline jetliner, certainly was familiar to me in my youth, about to take off. On September 11th, 1974, Eastern Airlines Flight 212 goes down near Charlotte. The crash, one of the worst in state history, initiates lasting changes to the rules surrounding takeoffs and landings. Written, as always, by Mr. Philip Gerard. Captain James Edward Reeves had not been scheduled to fly today, Wednesday, September 11th, 1974. But he plans to spend his 49th birthday next Friday with his family and has traded shifts for this midweek trip and another so he can spend his birthday weekend at home. He's an experienced hand with nearly 9,000 command hours under his belt. After flying empty from Atlanta, Eastern Airlines Flight 212 takes off on time at 7 a.m. from Charleston, South Carolina, with Reeves in command, bound for Chicago by way of Charlotte, one of Eastern's hubs, and authorized to follow an Instrument Flight Rules flight plan. The McConnell Douglas DC-9 Whisper Jet, with its two rear-mounted engines, carries 78 passengers and four crew members. Reeves' co-pilot is 36-year-old First Officer James M. Daniels, Jr., who has logged more than 3,000 flight hours, 2,693 of them in the DC-9. Responsible for cabin safety and service are two experienced flight attendants, 25-year-old Eugenia Kurth and 26-year-old Colette Watson, who today marks her sixth anniversary with the company. It's a short hop, but the flight attendants serve beverages en route. Among the mix of business and pleasure travelers is John Merriman, Walter Cronkite's editor for the CBS Evening News. 38 passengers have ties to the Charleston area. Francis Frank Cordes Ford, Jr., president of Ford's Ready Mix Concrete Company. Rear Admiral Charles Ward Cummings, recently appointed commandant of the 6th Naval District at Charleston. Walter Wayne Seal, anchor and news director for WCIV-TV in Charleston. Charles C.F. McDonald, Lewis Weston, and Jack Sanders, all managers with Charleston's News and Courier and Evening Post. And Dr. James William Colbert, Jr., Vice President for Academic Affairs at the Medical University of South Carolina, escorting his sons, Peter, aged 18, and Paul, aged 15, to a preparatory academy in Connecticut. Those boys were precious, Watson recalls. One of them asked for a hot chocolate, and I remember thinking, oh my gosh, the gear's going down any minute, but I got it for him and took it over. The first 20 minutes of the flight are routine. Beginning at 7:21 a.m., the cockpit voice recorder, CVR, picks up a continuous recorded broadcast by the Airport Terminal Information Service for all traffic. Charlotte weather, sky partially obscured, estimated ceiling 4,000, broken, 12,000 broken, visibility 1.5 inches, ground fog. In plain English, Charlotte's Douglas Municipal Airport is quickly disappearing in patchy, dense fog. Around 7:22 a.m., the Traffic Control Center in Atlanta radios clearance for Flight 212 to descend 8,000 feet, and within a minute, the autopilot disengages with an audible sound. First Officer Daniels now takes manual control of the aircraft. For the next few minutes, Captain Reeves responds to directions from Charlotte Approach Control, confirming altitude and approach path. The crew completes a quick in-range checklist. At 7:25, Atlanta clears Flight 212 for final approach to runway 36, where five other planes have landed so far this morning. But in between the crew's technical conversation about adjusting course headings and setting flap angles, there's a steady stream of talk. What the National Transportation Safety Board, NTSB, will later describe as conversations not pertinent to the operation of the aircraft. It goes on, those conversations covered a number of subjects, from politics to used cars, and both crew members expressed strong views and mild aggravation concerning the subjects discussed. While the pilot and first officer are conversing, an altitude alert tone signals that the plane is now approaching 6,000 feet. The controller advises the pilot to make a left turn, then directs the aircraft to descend and hold at 4,000 feet. They cross the Ross intersection, the fixed point for final approach, 5 miles from the runway. The captain calls out the correct minimum altitude required at that point in the glide path. Ross, 5.5, 1,800. But he's reading the figure from altimeter number 2, 1,800 feet, which indicates altitude above sea level. Altimeter number 1 displays the altitude above field level. The touchdown zone for runway 36 at Douglas Municipal Airport is 726 feet above sea level. Reeves begins to see landmarks through holes in the thick ground fog. Carowinds, he says. Daniels responds, ah, that tower. Would that tower be it or not? Referring to the 340-foot-tall observation tower at the amusement park. Carowinds, Reeves replies. I don't think it is. We're too far in. Carowinds is in back of us, Daniels said. I believe it is. The captain now agrees. That looks like it. You know, it's Carowinds. Reeves lowers the landing gear and they complete a pre-landing checklist. A few seconds later, the terrain warning sounds a steady alert tone along with blinking lights and then goes silent. As the NTSB report later makes clear, the tone and the lights are continuous until canceled by either pilot. The DC-9 Whisper jet rushes past its designated final approach fix toward runway 36 with an airspeed of 168 knots and with the flight crew somehow unaware already 450 feet below the minimum altitude for a safe landing. The NTSB recovers the final moments. According to the CVR, at 07:33:52, the captain said, "Yeah, we're all ready." Followed shortly thereafter by, all we got to do is find the airport. 5 seconds later, Daniels responds, yeah. Then both men shout. The CVR records impact. Watson, belted into the jump seat behind the cockpit, remembers the terrifying moment. All of a sudden, there was a huge jolt, and the airplane hit and bounced back up twice, and my first thought was, the gear has collapsed. I'm looking out at the first-class cabin, and it was already on fire and getting all smoked up, flames everywhere. It was really, really, really a frightening experience to know that all those people were just on fire. The DC-9 strikes a grove of small trees 3.3 miles short of the runway. It careens nearly 200 feet across a cornfield into larger trees, the right wing shearing off and leaking fuel. The tail section breaks off. The forward cabin slams to a halt almost 1,000 feet beyond the point of initial impact, already burning. The two exit doors blocked by a tree and the ground. The overwing exits blocked by burning jet fuel. The exit in the tail section can be opened, but survivors in the rear of the aircraft are thrown free or escape through holes in the wreckage. First Officer Daniels suffers severe impact injuries to both legs and minor body lacerations. Watson survives the crash with minor injuries. With the galley and forward doors blocked, she tries to jerk open the door to the cockpit, secured against skyjackers by a latch that can be opened only from inside. Daniels releases the latch. Watson and the 45-year-old business passenger named Francis C. Mihalek enter the cockpit. "I knew that the captain was dead because I heard his death rattle," Watson recalls. A left window exit is open, and Mihalek, badly burned and lacerated, one arm broken, squeezes through. He went out that window, leg, body, leg, and he stepped on the tree trunk that was blocking my forward passenger door, Watson recalls. She scrambles out next and enlists the aid of a commuter who has seen the crash and stopped to help. They reach into the cockpit and haul Daniels out to safety. Then Watson attends to other injured passengers. She recounts, "I saw a young girl, maybe 18, 19 years old, and she had beautiful red hair, and it was singed to the roots." Watson lays her down on a passenger's coat. She said, "I want my mama." And she said, "Will you pray with me?" And we said the Lord's Prayer together. The young woman dies a week later. In all, 72 people are killed, though many survived the initial crash. One of them hangs on for 29 days after the crash before succumbing to impact injuries and severe burns. The NTSB calculates the grim tally. 32 are killed on impact. All of the others die from burns, smoke inhalation, or a combination of injuries. Captain Reeves, Frank Ford Jr., Rear Admiral Charles Ward Cummings, Wayne Seal, C.F. McDonald, Lewis Weston, Jack Sanders, John Merriman, and Eugenia Kurth all perish. Dr. James William Colbert, Jr., and his sons Peter and Paul are also among the fatalities, leaving behind a large family that includes 10-year-old Stephen Colbert, the future television host and comedian. At 7:40, emergency services arrive and notify firefighters and rescue crews from the Steel Creek Volunteer Fire Department, who bring the intense fire under control in a matter of minutes and remain on the scene for about 3 hours. It takes about 45 minutes for ambulances to transport all of the survivors to hospitals. The crash of Eastern Airlines Flight 212 is one of the worst in the state's history, and at the center of the calamity lies a mystery articulated in the NTSB report. The board has been unable to determine the precise reason for the almost total lack of altitude awareness on the part of the crew throughout the approach. The extensive experience of both pilots may have worked against them. Rather than being laser-focused on a difficult landing in fog, they seemed, according to the NTSB, to exhibit an attitude that lax and casual. Indeed, First Officer Daniels testifies, "The only thing I can say is everything appeared to be normal." Ultimately, the NTSB cites the probable cause of the crash as the flight crew's lack of altitude awareness at critical points during the approach due to poor cockpit discipline. Unfortunately, the board finds such serious lapses in expected professional conduct are all too common, as demonstrated by 5 previous approach accidents. It recommends new protocols to the FAA. The result is the sterile cockpit rule, finally codified in 1981. Below 10,000 feet, conversation or other activity not directly related to the operation and safety of the aircraft is prohibited. The rule is designed to focus a flight crew's full attention during the critical phases of takeoff and landing, the most potential dangerous potentially dangerous of any flight. But no rule can bring consolation to the loved ones of all those lost in Flight 212. Sylvester Reeves, Captain Reeves' father, tells a reporter from the Associated Press, "That boy was my pride and joy. For some time now, I've had funny dreams and premonitions, and I just had a funny feeling something was going to happen." Coming in October in this series, a flood of urban strangers arrive in Appalachia. You're listening to Our State Magazine on the North Carolina Reading Service. Any comments, questions? 919-781. Nope, that's Carter Glass's number. 919-832-5138. Insurance questions go to 919-781-1973. All right. It's time now to dig into the main articles, and we're going to do now the Cheerful Giver, sharing homemade canned goods and fresh vegetables from a backyard garden is a tradition born of hardship. Today, this custom is symbolic of the deep ties that bind our communities. Written by Bridget A. Lacey. A basket filled with homemade preserves and jams left by a friend on the front porch of my Raleigh home. A batch of soup made from scratch and sent over when I'm feeling under the weather. A sack of fresh tomatoes or a vase of flowers, just because I have a name for these random acts of generosity. Mason jar kindness. The tradition of giving away canned goods and produce from backyard gardens has long been a gesture of affection. For African-American families, it's also served historically as a way of letting visiting relatives, those who left the South or other areas of the country during the Great Migration, to take a little piece of home back to places like New York City or Washington, D.C. Those jars of sustenance are reminders of the soil on which one was born. My maternal grandfather, Papa, always sent dinner guests away with something from his pantry. You couldn't leave my grandparents' home without toting a jar of crunchy bread and butter pickles, savory pickled watermelon rinds, or sugary pear preserve. It was his way of preserving important relationships. Every time you'd reach for that jar filled with deliciousness, you'd think of Papa. For my family, the act of sharing food cemented a bond between households and generations. It was hospitality born of necessity because in the Jim Crow South, home-prepared foods served as guaranteed goodness to offset the hostility and uncertainty that black folks may have encountered during travels outside of the home. I've tried to carry this tradition on of generosity even though I lack the space for a garden or the talent for canning. I'll pick up produce from the farmer's market, German Johnson and Cherokee purple tomatoes, or sweet fall golden delicious and pink lady apples for the people I love. For several years, I served as the food, health, and beauty chair of the North Carolina Museum of History's annual African American Cultural Celebration, which kicks off Black History Month by bringing together black farmers, bakers, and restaurant owners to share their own stories of mason jar kindness. Every year when I hear them speak of learning to cook from grandparents, their tales transport me back to my own grandfather's double-lot garden all those years ago. I see the two apple trees whose branches met in the sky, forming an endless bridge of hope for me. During those meditative moments in the garden with my papa, the great beauty of the world inspired me to capture it all in word images. The smokehouse, the goldfish pond stocked with bright orange swimmers, the doghouse and rabbit cages filled with their respective inhabitants. I can still hear the chatter from my cousins and sisters, and I can taste the peach and pear preserves that Papa would lovingly can and pack from my garden, my parents' faux wood paneled Mercury station wagon to send back home with us. I imagine that the tradition of sharing homegrown and homemade food comes not just from African-American families like my own, but from any working-class family with little money but lots of watermelons, cantaloupes, and sweet potatoes grown in backyard gardens. Meager resources express themselves in kindness. I have to confess that I was known to pay a former handyman with a little bit of cash, along with a package of thinly sliced Johnson County ham and homemade peach preserves, wrapped in a whole lot of appreciation. And did I mention that he would bring me pork tenderloin biscuits, still warm, or produce from his garden, garnished with friendship and affection? The offering is free, but the gift is priceless. It's heartwarming, says Carol Quiglis, a retired private chef. Her father, Milton D. Quiglis Sr., founded the historic Quiglis Clinic Hospital in Tarboro in 1946 to provide health care to the African-American community when there were no other options. To the larger world, Dr. Quiglis may have been a big mover and shaker, but at home he was just another friend, neighbor, and father who taught his daughter the value of mason jar kindness. Daddy liked to give away brandied old figs in mason jars, Carol remembers. He was proud of them. The mason jar showed off the craftsmanship of the gift. Canning and gardening, like friendship and parenthood, are acts of faith. They require weathering storms, droughts, and uncertainty. My folks share a deep respect for those sacred spaces where vegetables, fruits, and herbs grow, and for kitchens where they're transformed into delicious nourishment for the body and soul. We understand, though, that there's more to a garden than what's planted in the earth, and more to a mason jar than the pickles stuffed inside it. There's a lot of love there, and that's something that we can all preserve. This next article is entitled Jars of Joy, Jams and Jellies, Chow Chows and Relishes, Pickles and Sauerkrauts. These 15 businesses have perfected the art of preserving the garden's bounty, taking the homegrown tradition to a new level with inventive and classic flavors, written by Liz Johnson. Garnet Gals in Andrews. Garnet Spencer passed down her love of preserves to her daughter and granddaughter, Andrea and Megan Lambert. Now the Lamberts carry on her traditions with their business named in her honor. Andrea runs the herb garden, and Megan, a professional chef, dreams up new flavor combinations like beet marmalade and vanilla pear jam. Miss Ruth's Jams in Apex. Ruth Taylor started out making jam for her friends and family. As the business has grown to larger commercial accounts, she's maintained the hospitality at the heart of Mrs. Ruth's. In addition to offering signature flavors like Belgian chocolate strawberry and blueberry orange, Taylor often collaborates with customers to recreate childhood memories or family recipes. They're at MrsRuthsJams.com. And for before, I didn't notice there was a web address. For Garnet Gals, it's GarnetGals.com. How about Sweet Brined, Asheville? Before opening Sweet Brined, Benjamin Hancock taught fermentation as an occupation skills activity at a rehabilitation center in Asheville. Now he continues sharing his love of fermentation at local farmers markets with crowd pleasers like sauerkraut and kimchi, and classics like dill pickles, Hancock's personal favorite. SweetBrined.com. Willoughby Goods in Durham. After 4 years of backyard beekeeping, Chantelle Farrell is rediscovering her passion for cooking whilst also building a business. Farrell started selling homemade jams at the Black Farmers Market last year, reconnecting with a family-preserving tradition. She's now in the process of expanding her business to include pickled veggies, honey, and more. Instagram.com/WilloughbyGoods. Imladris Farm in Fairview. Imladris Farm has been in the Harrell family for seven generations, and Walter and Wendy Harrell are dedicated to sustainable agriculture and production to maintain their family's legacy. They grow their own berries and purchase fruit from other local mountain farms to create timeless classics like blackberry, blueberry, and raspberry jams. ImladrisFarms.com. Mariah's Gourmet Relishes in Fayetteville. Her grandmother's chow chow was a staple throughout Phyllis Haynes' childhood. Now she shares this recipe with the rest of the world. Gourmet relishes in mild, medium, or hot brighten any meal as a dip, a topping for yesterday's leftovers, or a mix-in for a fresh salad. MariahsRelishes.com. Wildflower Bakery in Gloucester. In the White's Home Bakery, just east of Beaufort, Gary makes the baked goods and Kathy makes the jam to spread on top. The couple sells sweet treats like whiskey fig cakes and scrumptious spreads like strawberry margarita jam and pear rosemary preserves at the old Beaufort Farmers Market and other seasonal markets. They're on Facebook as Wildflower Bakery Jams. Blue Ridge Jams in Hendersonville. Linda Justice opened the Sugar Shack in 1961, and it's been in the family since. Current owners, Robin and Steve Pridmore, changed the name to Blue Ridge Jams for wholesale to local shops and restaurants. But you can still find the Sugar Shack label at farmers markets in and around Hendersonville. Blue Ridge has around 120 flavors. Crowd favorites include habanero raspberry and strawberry fig. BlueRidgeJam.com. How about Outer Banks Olive Oil in Kill Devil Hills? Laura and Phil Whalen started selling gourmet olive oil about 9 years ago and have since expanded their offerings to include all sorts of artisanal foods. Some of their most popular preserved goods include the OBX Traffic Jam, Tangerine, Orange, and Elderberry, and Ghost Pepper Salsa. You can find their storefronts in Kill Devil Hills, Duck, and Nag's Head. OuterBanksOlive.com. And lastly, Peggy Rose's Jellies in Wake Forest. Peggy Rose Newsom grew up on a farm and learned to make preserves at a younger age. Her signature product, Pepper Jelly, is a southern tradition with a twist of cranberry or ghost pepper, best served simply with crackers and cheese. A jar of champagne mustard completes the spread. PeggyRoses.com. And the folks I didn't get to cover are Crowbar Farm Foods in Little Switzerland, Serotonin Ferments in Marshall, Fiddlehead Farm in Pittsburgh, Copper Pot Wooden Spoon in Waynesville, and the Carolina Country Store in Wilmington. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of this month's episode of Our State Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and that you'll be sure to listen next time. I'm Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine was underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Our State Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org, and on iTunes. If you have any comments or questions, call the studios 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.